It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. If you love to listen to Iowa Public Radio on the weekends, this hour is made for you. Later this hour, I'll talk with Ira Glass, creator, host, and producer of This American Life. He'll be in Cedar Falls Saturday evening at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Center for Performing Arts. But first, you know her as a regular panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and from 30-some years of being hilarious on stage, Paula Poundstone is here. She's a stand-up comedian, podcaster, author, cat lady, and many other things. Her podcast, which she co-hosts with Adam Felber, is called Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone, and her latest book, now out in paperback, is The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. She'll be at Hoyt Sherman Place in Des Moines on Friday night, and I also know that some fortunate new or renewing members of Iowa Public Radio are finding out this morning that they won tickets to that show. But if you didn't win, tickets are still available, and Paula is with me on the telephone. Hi, Paula.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And I've billed this as the meeting of two crazy cat ladies, so I think it makes sense that we really start our conversation there. How many kitties do you have now, Paula?
I have 14.
Wonderful. That makes me sound so sane, and I really enjoy that about you. Do you still, last time we talked, you had a cat cam going where people could watch your kitties on the web. Are you still monitoring their behavior that way?
No, we don't have the cat cam anymore. It was a loss.
The nation.
It was a loss for the nation and perhaps the world. You know, it is the World Wide Web after all. I'm sure a lot of people found their mornings purposeless around the world once that was gone. My cat Luigi just got back from the vet yesterday. He had 8 teeth pulled, and the vet says to me, he gave me some like pain medication for him, and he says, "Oh, you don't just spray it in his mouth. You put it. It comes in a syringe, but you put it between the gums and the cat's lips." And I said, "Oh, okay."
How has that been going?
I don't think Luigi's going to get any pain medication. I think he's just going to have to tough it out because he's 14 pounds, and every one of those 14 pounds does not want me to put that medicine in his mouth.
Even without teeth, it's still a dangerous proposition.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's just muscular, you know. Even without his claws, he could just thump you to death. You know, he's just a big old, it's like trying to medicate Muhammad Ali if he didn't want it, I think. He's smaller. Okay, he's smaller.
But, a little smaller,
you know, it's just that sort of powerful punch. You know, he can move my hands. He can, he's strong, and he does have, he does still have, well, he has 2 teeth up front, and my assistant Wendell was very concerned that he wouldn't be able to eat. I'm like, how do you think he got to be 14 pounds to begin with? He had no problem. He'll eat his way through the pain. It doesn't matter.
When you are on the road, you're on the road so often doing your stand-up shows, is it your assistant that gets to take care of the cats?
Sometimes. But the woman who was my nanny for 20-something years and took care of the cats when I was gone as well as the children, she continues to take care of the cats. She doesn't live here, but she stays here when I'm gone.
How do you cope with that? I mean, you're on the road so much, and you've been doing that for so long.
I put a bowl of food down for her.
No, how do you personally cope with all of that travel?
Well, I have a new system on the airplane, I just put a blanket over my head, and I wear a baseball cap all the time anyway. Well, not all the time. I don't wear it on stage, but in my regular life, I generally am wearing a baseball cap. And so it creates this little cocoon because of the visor of the cap. And so there's a little cocoon under there. And now I can sleep. It's not a thick blanket. And so really the sun comes through. I can actually read under there. I eat under there. It's great. It's like I have a little pod that I travel in now. I'm thinking of using it everywhere I go.
Yeah, sure.
You know, if I go to like a restaurant, I'd just rather be alone even though I'm out.
Well, someone once told me that I can't remember what the percentage was, but some insanely high percentage of people who fly domestically wind up getting a cold within, 5 days of getting off of a plane. And you're on a plane pretty much every week, right?
So they're getting that cold from me.
Right. But do you think the blanket is protecting you from germs as well?
The blanket's protecting me from, the blanket is protecting me from the embarrassment of how my head hangs and my mouth hangs open, which I really prefer everyone not observe, even though it's just part of the human condition. I don't get sick from flying. I have allergies all the time, and so it's very hard to tell when I'm actually sick. But I don't get sick. I mean, have I ever gotten sick from flying? Probably, but not at such a rate like that. Not every time I fly. That would be crazy. I'm trying to think if there's any other good benefits to travel. Not that I can think of. Although, in the hotels, I have a podcast called Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone, and I have a hard time explaining in an intriguing way what the podcast is. It's a comedy podcast. We have guests on to talk about different topics, but really, although one could certainly learn something about whatever topic that might be, it really is just bringing sort of grist for the comedy mill. See what I mean? I don't explain it very good. And therefore, we have a contest on our Facebook page now of asking listeners to come up with a clever, compelling, short description of the show and the listener that comes up with the best such description wins a fresh hotel soap.
Wow.
So there is that aspect of travel, yeah, which is I have got a steady stream of fresh hotel soap.
And you're willing to share one with the winning contributor.
Yes, and
very
not only
generous.
That, but I believe we're putting up pictures of the soaps so that the listener gets the full selection, because there is quite a selection.
Well, let's talk about this podcast. As you mentioned, you co-host it with Adam Felber. And
well, I didn't mention that I co-host it with Adam Felber, but I should have.
Okay.
So I'm glad you backed
having,
up. And
having listened to it, it actually makes sense to me that you didn't mention that, but I did. So
yeah.
Did you and Adam meet through Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? Of course, he's a regular panelist as well.
We did. And he was... He was a regular panelist before I was a regular panelist. When I first started doing the show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, for those who don't know, is a weekly news quiz show, comedy news quiz show made by NPR. And the show itself has been on the air for 20 years. I've been with them for 17. And when I first showed up, the way they did the show was not in front of an audience. They did it, and we weren't all together. We were in whatever studio nearest where we lived. So nobody flew, and nobody, nobody bowed. So Adam was in New York. Peter was in Chicago. Carl was in D.C. I was in Los Angeles. And Adam was visiting L.A. one time, I think, and we were on the show together, and so we were in the same studio together. I think that was how we met. And then over a little bit of time, we get to know each other, and then he moved out here, him and his wife. And I still didn't know him all that well, but I knew I really liked him. And he knew my family. He had met them by then. I asked him one day, because I was going to be out of town, and my kids had to be in, three different places. And even my nanny could only do so much. And so I asked Adam if he would take my son to a hockey lesson. That is a huge ask. That's beyond let me use your truck for moving.
That's almost as much as would you please put medicine on the gums of my cat?
Well, yeah, that you'd get sued for. But, because he's not going to let you do that. But, this is a huge... I'll tell you what would have been easier is could you take my cat to a hockey lesson? That would have been easy. It would have been easier to get him dressed. So anyways, that I had already met Adam, but that was the experience that made Adam really a keeper.
All right.
And so, he did it, by the way. That's the other thing. He didn't blow me off. He did it.
That's impressive.
I'm sure he did a fine job.
That is friendship, for sure.
Yeah.
So did you come up with the idea for a podcast first, or did the two of you come up with this idea together?
Actually, we did another podcast together that was the brainchild of Doug Berman from Don't Tell Me and Car Talk fame.
Mm-hmm.
And Doug was the executive producer on Wait Wait and Car Talk. And he had the idea for another podcast, which we called Live from the Poundstone Institute. And we were auditioning, sidekick role people. And Adam had helped us out with some practice shows, playing various roles. One time maybe he did the sidekick thing once, or maybe he didn't. I don't think he did. He would pretend to be a person calling in when we were doing these practice shows. And I guess Doug said to him at one point, do you have any ideas for somebody who could work with Paul? And Adam said, yeah, I have a really good one. And he suggested Adam Felber.
Nice.
And so we began working together on that. And it was a really fun podcast to do. But it was, it was the endowment at the Poundstone Institute was big. And so we ended up curtailing that podcast. And then Adam and I joined forces on another idea.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about that in just a moment. We're going to have to take a short break. My guest right now is comedian, author, podcaster Paula Poundstone. She'll be performing at Hoyt Sherman Place in Des Moines on Friday night, and we will continue our conversation. You're welcome to join us, by the way. If you have questions that you'd like to ask Paula Poundstone, give us a call, 866-780-9100, or tweet us at iowapublicradio.org. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in about 15 minutes, I'll talk with Ira Glass, creator, host, and producer of This American Life. He's going to be in Cedar Falls on Saturday at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Center for Performing Arts. And right now, my guest is Paula Poundstone. She is going to be at Hoyt Sherman Place in Des Moines on Friday night. And there are still tickets available for that as well. Paula Poundstone, stand-up comedian, podcaster, author, of course, a regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And just before the break, Paula, we were talking about the podcast that you do with Adam Felber, Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone. And I'm curious about two comedians working together. I mean, in many of the episodes, obviously you have a great deal of fun together, but it kind of puts Adam into the straight man role. Did you guys talk about that, or is that just part of the dynamic that developed?
Yeah, I guess it has just sort of developed. We didn't have a plan. It was like spaghetti. You know, we've just sort of thrown it up on the wall and saw what sticks. I don't know. Adam's very funny. Adam gets off lots and lots of funny lines. Every now and then, I sort of look at him and I'm laughing, and then I realize I'm just sitting there. and that perhaps more is required of me in my work than that. He's great.
So on the podcast, I mean, you have a lot of fun together. You also interview people. You've done a whole series, for example, about people just talking about their jobs. And it's very funny, but the idea behind it is your exploring it to see if it's a job that you could do. I recently listened to, I think it was your latest episode, where you were talking with an event planner, a job you decided you definitely could not and should not do. I'm curious about what, you have a lot of fun on the show, but what was your concept to begin with, and how has it changed?
My initial idea was that we do a show that I was calling how to move out of your parents' house. And that we were interviewing people, you know, that would be a comedy show, obviously, but that we were interviewing people to find out the basic information that you need to live as an adult. And that would really apply to everyone. I mean, I'm 59, but I'm still, you know, trying to figure out how to live as an adult. As it turns out, it's a quest that never ends if you take it seriously. And so that was my, you know, started out with that as a backstory, you know, but as time goes on, you know, you find that this thing is more fun to talk about than that thing, or you find that it's fun to add this in. I mean, that's kind of the joy of the whole podcast thing, is that there are no real rules. You got no suits. Nobody telling you what you have to do or can't say. And that's, you know, pretty rare in any kind of performing experience.
Right. You've spent a lot of time on social media, interacting with your fans directly that way. Do you feel like podcasting gives you a different way to interact with people?
Yeah. They can enjoy the show while they do the dishes, while they run. I mean, lots of people tell me when I'm out on the road, will tell me that they listen to the podcast for their commute. You know, which is gratifying, by the way. It makes me really happy. And they seem to enjoy the fact that Adam's on every show, and I think it was intended to be a compliment when the first person said it. I can't remember if they said it in review or one of the things that we do is we ask people to submit their theme songs, theme songs for the Paula Poundstone, for Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone. And maybe it was in one of those where one of the lyrics was, "And Adam's on every show." And it's become kind of a thing. So people come up to me all the time. And they say they really enjoy it. And they go, "And Adam's on every show." not sure that Adam understands it as the compliment that it's meant to be.
But, or just an observation. Yeah. All right. So we are going to go to the phones here. You are welcome to join our conversation, 866-780-9100. And I also want to talk with you about some of the things you've discovered about happiness from your totally unscientific study of the search for human happiness, which is now out in paperback. But let's talk to Laura first. Laura in Des Moines. Hi, Laura.
Hi, thank you. So I'm a huge fan, Paula. You were touring the comedy shows, and you came to Atlanta, Georgia, where I'm from originally. Must have been like late 80s, early 90s, and that's kind of when I first saw you, and I was just like, wow, because you're kind of one of the groundbreaking women of comedy as far as I'm concerned. And I know you're from the South and you worked at IHOP. I worked at IHOP. And so we have that in common. I do like cats.
We are practically the same person, you and me.
I know. We're basically the same people. But
what do we do for a living? what do you do for a living?
So I have an eco-friendly cleaning business and I started
so I could
be home with my kids. Yeah. But I have a lot of other interests, and comedy is definitely one of them. Comedy and music, I think, are what keeps us a little sane. But I do appreciate when you were a correspondent, a political correspondent on The Tonight Show during the 92 presidential campaign, and that was brilliant. So thank you for all that you've done for comedy, and I'm so glad you're still touring, and welcome to Des Moines.
Thank you very much. Boy, speaking of the nexus of comedy and politics, I can't imagine what it's like to live in Iowa, especially as we build up to, 2020. It must just be awful. Can you go anywhere, get a cup of coffee or a diet soda without some horrible politician coming up to you?
I can dodge them pretty easily, Laura. Do you keep running into them?
Well, I've actually made it a policy for myself this year. I'm not actually going to go to any rallies, and I'm not picking anybody until later after the summer, because I have to kind of keep my mental health in check, and there's so much going on that I think we can kind of get a little bit carried away with it. So I'm watching, I'm commenting on Facebook, but I'm not making any decisions, and I'm not going to any rallies right now. I just kind of am holding back because it will be intense starting in the fall and running up to the caucuses, and it will be, and it will literally be like that. You will run into people. In fact, you should go to Raygun T-shirt shop and check out their caucus area at this great T-shirt shop in the East Village while you're in town. It's hilarious. Very funny.
Oh, I should do that. That sounds like fun. I think you're right. I mean, I think they started so early, and I know they always start earlier, you know, early, but they start earlier every year. You know, it's a little bit like advertising for Christmas or something, every election cycle.
We had potential candidates coming to the state as soon as the 2016 election ended.
Wow.
Honestly.
Wow.
Although they weren't declared at that point, but they kept popping up around the state. So I think the worst part is all of the giant straw bales that we have around for the national media, just to remind them that they're in Iowa. You trip over them wherever you go. So.
Oh, that is so funny. I'll bet you if somebody looks into it, it's going to turn out that Iowans are like stockpiling coffee and beverages so that they don't have to go out of the house, and they're having like underground coffee gatherings just so that they can be alone,
We'll have to look into this. This is begging for an investigative journalistic report on that. I mentioned your book out now in paperback, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, which is a really enjoyable read. And
thank you.
I was curious. It's very funny, but it's also memoir as well. I mean, you write quite a bit about your life as a single mom raising three kids, and a lot of the challenges, funny, maybe not so funny, that you've been through with them over the years. Do they have any rules about what you're allowed to use in comedy or in writing?
I have no idea. They pay no attention to what I do. They have no interest in my shows. They would never read anything that I wrote.
Oh, so you have kind of a free rein then.
You know, one time after my first book came out, I remember my son Thomas, it just sort of dawned on him one day. And he said, I don't know how old he was at that time, maybe 8, 9. And he asked me if I talked about him like on stage, and I said, yeah, I do. And I said, but let me explain something. I said two things. I said, if the stories I was telling were so wild and unique just to us, and nobody ever did that, right? Then people wouldn't laugh. They would look at me like I was a freak. I said, you know, the stories that I tell are things that are part of the human experience. And the reason that people laugh is because they recognize that human experience. And they say, oh, geez, we're not the only ones. You know, and that's part of the purpose of that kind of storytelling anyways, is to make people feel less alone, you know, in their struggles and their you know, sometimes failings. And by the way, they're not really jokes about my kids. They're jokes about me
trying to
figure out parenting. And then the other thing I said to him, which is true, is that I often exaggerate. Not
what?
Always, but often.
Oh my goodness, this
and,
is shocking.
And he seems, you know, maybe this wasn't intended to be a lease forever, but he seemed satisfied with that answer, and so I So I decided that
you would go with it.
Yeah, that it was a good. And I don't much, you know. I don't know. Now they're all young adults, and
yeah. Are you? You're an empty nester now, except for the cats. And how many dogs?
Oh, I have one dog.
Okay.
I had two. They were a year apart, and then one of them just didn't get up one day. Mm. And they're not. They weren't old. I have no idea what made that dog, you know, what killed that dog. I have no idea. But I wasn't home when it occurred, but I can say that the night before, we were playing in the backyard with the flashlight, which was her favorite thing in the world. And she was, you know, she chases the light beam and was as enthusiastic and active as any dog I've ever seen. But I only tell that story to say, I am looking for another dog. If somebody has a golden retriever or golden retriever mixed puppy, please be in touch with the station, and then they'll get in touch with me.
Oh, my goodness. You're asking for it.
There it was.
There's
my plea. Because my dog, Sirius, I think, you know, could use the companionship now that the other dog is gone. And my dog, Sirius, volunteers at a nursing home. He's a very good dog. He goes and talks politics at a nursing home two mornings a week.
Okay. So
just jigsaw puzzles.
I mentioned the book, and the book, the concept of the book is that you try out different things that are supposed to ideally make you a happier person, and you go through your adventures and misadventures with these things and then evaluate whether they make you happier or not. And a lot of them do. In looking at happiness in that way and the experiences that you had for the book and that you had just for life, do you feel like you actually learned something about what does make us happy?
Yeah, I think I did. I think, first of all, that the kind of happiness, I'm not talking about whether or not I enjoy something. I'm talking about something that gives you a bounce. So, for example, in my book, every chapter was written as an experiment with the conditions and the hypothesis and the field notes and the qualitative and quantitative observations and the variables, etc. But the analysis part of each chapter was checking back in with my regular life to see, which at the time was raising a house full of kids and animals and being a stand-up comic and just being stuck being me 24 hours a day. And so I wanted to see whether whether the variable was affecting, you know, the sort of overall happiness of my life, because otherwise it's worthless. You know, if you're up on a Ferris wheel, which I very much enjoy, and you don't feel good later as a result, then it wasn't much help, because you're not going to be up on a Ferris wheel your whole life.
It was fun for a little while, but
it's very brief. A couple of turns, you're off, and you have to stand in line. So that was the question. So I guess what I'm looking for is something that really is a chemical reaction. I think that's what it boils down to, anyways. Is sort of body chemistry and what kicks that chemistry off. But I guess the thing that I really learned, A, is that the answer is stuff we've always been told, and it's just such a drag of an answer that I wasn't really enthusiastic about learning it, which is physical exercise is really important. I wish it wasn't. I wish the answer was sitting in a chair eating Doritos, because that I'm good at. And the actual act of doing the physical exercise is not necessarily pleasant. But the rewards are, because I've studied this totally unscientifically, the rewards, I think, are lasting. Do last, so that when you do your hour workout or your long walk or whatever it is, and now you go about your business of doing your day, and you do feel better. You probably feel better for more than one reason. Like if it's maybe there's weight loss involved, Maybe not. Not necessarily, but perhaps. It just feels better not carrying as much around. But the other thing is, I think I felt the more physically active I was, the more sort of full of possibility I felt. And the other thing that I think that I learned is that to some degree it's a concerted effort.
All right.
Think about it.
We're out of time, Paula, but
thank you
so much for talking with me today.
Well, it was nice talking with you. Thanks so much.
Paula Poundstone will be at Hoyt Sherman Place in Des Moines on Friday night. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Back in 1995, when This American Life first went on the air on WBEZ in Chicago, Ira Glass may have believed that he was just launching an ambitious new kind of radio show, and he was, but he was also starting a revolution that not only changed public radio, but has influenced storytelling of all kinds. He continues to inspire and to make great radio and is very generous with sharing his process and ideas about storytelling with devoted listeners and aspiring storytellers. He'll be talking about his life, lessons learned, and some nuts and bolts of telling stories at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center in Cedar Falls on Saturday at 7 p.m. And he is here with me now. Hello, Ira.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And you're coming up on your 25th anniversary, if I've done my math right. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah, I guess it's true. Yeah.
How does that feel?
I hadn't thought about it at all, but now I'll have to think about it. It feels like just getting in there trying to, you know, pitch one game at a time.
So when the show went national, way back when now, I was working at a small station in Indiana, and the program director there put the show on the air but was really nervous about some of your edgier material. So she demanded that she have evergreen shows that she could keep at the station just in case you guys
this
went
was not
too
unusual.
Far.
This was not unusual. Like in the early years of the show, we had what we called a hot list of stations that we had to call if there was any material we thought that they might be worried about. And it was the way we got onto the stations. The stations are like, we're just very worried about you. And so for years, for a decade more, we had a hot list of stations who there was somebody on staff who on Fridays or sometimes earlier in the week would call out to them saying, like, hey, this weekend's show, here's what we're doing.
Wow. So, it's so funny to think about that now because This American Life has become such a flagship program for public radio. And I think our ideas of what is edgy have changed a lot. Do you feel
I know. It's funny. It's really like when you hear, I don't know, like that people would walk out of Rachmaninoff concerts, you know, and rioting, you know, when they would hear this crazy music. Yeah, I know. It does seem a little strange to me, too.
But I think it's also really indicative of how much you changed public radio, you and the other producers and storytellers involved in This American Life. I mean, you really opened a new doorway, and maybe the rest of us are willing to give you more credit for that than you might be willing to take. But do you think about how things really did change in the 10 years after you launched that show?
I mean, it's funny. It's really just in the last year or two that people have really started to point this out, like all the time, that this is like a thing that happened. And I feel like, oh, I do have to acknowledge that. Yeah, no, there's a whole world of shows, you know, and people getting into public radio. Like, we're running an excerpt this week on our show from Michael Lewis, America's greatest nonfiction writer, I think, who wrote Moneyball and The Big Short, and he's making a podcast. And I was like, what happened that this guy, like, Malcolm Gladwell has a podcast? I just feel like, it's the most surprising thing that's happened, like, out of the whole thing. And it's very satisfying.
Absolutely.
To see. And because I had this feeling, like, when we started This American Life, like, there's a whole way to use the medium that people don't use it for. When we started, it was in the 90s and public radio was firmly established and it did beautiful work, but people weren't doing this kind of narrative journalism that we're doing where there are characters and scenes and feelings and funny moments and emotional moments as a kind of a regular thing. And then we became such a visible example of it. Of that kind of storytelling, other people heard it and they're like, oh, that seems kind of fun. You know what I mean? Like, and Radio Lab was the first show to kind of like take that format and do something else with it that we weren't doing, and Snap Judgment. And, you know, there's like there have been different ones along the way. And now it's just like this thing. There's like a whole genre of podcasting that's built around that kind of story. And like, for me, I always had this feeling of like, oh, there's this thing that radio was widely understood to be good for back in the 30s, you know, like when it was the prime mass medium. That is just really a great medium for like telling engaging stories about people, and you want to see what's going to happen to them. And it was weird to me when I started This American Life that it wasn't used for that anymore. But I never expected that it was going to be anybody but us doing it. Like I really the way I thought of the show and the staff thought of the show, and Tori Malatia, who I started the show with, who we make fun of each week, but like the show wouldn't exist without him. The way we thought of it is that, like, well, this is like the kind of show that we like, but it's like an indie movie, you know?
Right.
It's not for everybody, but like it's sort of like it's our taste. Like it's not necessarily for everybody, but like we're gonna make it because we kind of like it.
And it turns out it was for almost everybody. You know, you talk about what radio was like in the 30s, and I've heard you talk about that before, in that sense of intimacy in broadcasting. And it strikes me that in some ways, broadcasting has become even more intimate. I mean, you're no longer just in a room with a radio or in a car with a radio, but so often you are in your own head with a radio, with your earbuds in, listening in a way that we would never have thought of, I think, back in 1995.
Yeah, that's really true. Yeah. Podcasting has just taken what radio was and gone further.
So podcasting, of course, has exploded, and there are incredible podcasts out there. There are lots and lots and lots and lots of mediocre podcasts out there. I mean, so much content out there. What do you love? What do you get a chance to hear? I realize you're a busy guy, but what do you get a chance to hear that you're excited about in podcasting?
I mean, it's a range of things. Like, I do really love narrative, you know, journalism. And right now, I think the best podcast out there in the country, and I would recommend to anybody who's hearing this, and we know statistically that 3/4 of you have never listened to a podcast. So if you're feeling left out of this conversation, please know you're in the majority if you haven't heard a podcast. The New York Times does a daily news show called The Daily. That's like 20 minutes long. I listen at double speed. It's great. It's basically they do one story and do it in depth and do it as narrative. Do it as like it's a story. Like they kind of start at the beginning and it's just done with a lot of great editorial judgment. And then, you know, the other ones that I love tend to do that kind of thing. There's a one called Reply All that's a favorite. Heavyweight is a favorite. Both those are done by like our former staffers, but at other places now. But wonderful. Serial season 3, we all here feel very proud of.
Have you been surprised, like with Serial, how willing people are to dive that deeply into one story? And I mean, honestly, spend hours and hours and hours of their lives learning about all of the minute details of one case.
I mean, it's funny because now this is a completely established thing, and there are whole podcasts like Slow Burn and so many others that basically do this. There's a couple of true crime ones that are pretty good, and then a lot of true crime ones that I can't abide. But it really was just like a few years ago that we made Serial, 5 years ago, where the actual experiment, the thing we didn't know if it was going to happen, was can you tell a story and it last more than one episode and people will go with you? Like, we really didn't know if people would do that. I mean, obviously people do that with TV shows, but we didn't know if people would do that with a piece of journalism on the radio or on podcast. And in fact, there's all sorts of things in the design of Serial. So it's structured and packaged and designed. So it's more like TV than it is like radio in some very cunning ways that Julie Snyder and Sarah Koenig made, hoping to imitate the thing that would keep people listening forward in a television show or watching a TV show. But we really didn't know if it would work. And our expectations were, again, it would be kind of like, oh, this would be a thing. Like, I remember Sarah and Julie talking about it. Talking about Serial as, nobody's going to hear this, so we can just do whatever we want. And then it became clear within a few weeks that wasn't true. Like, within 4 weeks, they had an audience the size that it took This American Life to get to in 4 years. And then since then, they've kind of surpassed everything on public radio and in podcasting. Like each episode of Serial Season 1 has been downloaded 17 million times.
Wow.
Which is the same number of people who like watched the Game of Thrones finale last, you know, time Game of Thrones was on TV. Like, it was just like this mass market product in a way that like we didn't anticipate because nobody had ever done anything like it. Like it was just a completely new phenomenon for that to happen to a podcast or even for anything that public radio would make.
Yeah. Well, it seems so counterintuitive with, we know how rare it is really for people to be able to keep up to date on things that are going on in the world on a day-to-day basis and really follow the news. And yet people are willing to spend 18 hours diving into one particular story.
No, it's true. I mean, that's the interesting thing about this moment is that people talk about like everybody's reduced attention spans. And that, I think that it is so not true. It's so obviously not true. Like the biggest thing in the culture, other than what's going on politically, are you know, binge-worthy television shows that take like a week to get through, you know?
So when you do programs like the one you're going to do on Saturday night, you talk about storytelling, you talk about what inspires you, and also lessons learned from your successes and your failures. So I would love
for you... That makes it seem like a little more academic than what it is. Like really, it is really just an excuse for me to tell a bunch of stories that are really fun to tell and have videos and stuff.
And it's super fun to be in the audience. I can attest to that.
Yeah, I have to say, like it really, I'm somebody who on stage feels very nervous if people aren't laughing regularly. And so it's, you know, like I don't know. Yeah, so it's a little bit perhaps less high-minded than you're saying and more just out for fun.
Okay, but I would love for you to tell us about a failure that you've had that you learned something important from.
Oh, my God, there have been so many. I mean, my whole 20s, I was trying to make stories and not doing a good job of it. And that's something I talk about in the show. And I play something from like 8 years into my career where it's just terrible. Like I thought it was good, actually, the story I play. And I went back to it in writing the speech and I realized like, oh, this is awful. there's that. I mean, you know, like one thing that's kind of the most famous failure I think we've had on the show is a few years back. There was a guy who was not a journalist but a storyteller named Mike Daisy who came on the air, and I had seen his one man show where he went to China to go visit the places where Apple makes its various machines, and he told a story where we did fact check it for days and talked to many people to see if the things he was describing, you know, really happened in the plants. That Apple, you know, has its stuff made in Shenzhen, China. But the thing we didn't check, but we just made a mistake. We didn't talk to his interpreter and didn't reach her. And it turns out that the actual, like he has sort of specific incidents he talked about. I met this person, I did this, I went here. And it turned out that none of that was true. Like we learned after we broadcast that...
Yeah.
Another reporter found the interpreter who we had not found, and she's like, no, I don't. We never went there. We never met this person. None of this is real. And then we had to retract it, and we did a whole episode retracting it. And honestly, like I mean, we had always fact checked in the way that we fact check on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, which is the shows I worked for before this show, where an editor and a reporter would like go over, you know, the fact checking and kind of go over like, how do you know this, and you know, what do you know, but that experience, like of doing that episode and having that happen, like sent us into another level of fact checking. And you know, now we have professional, you know, like fact checkers. We have a team of people who we use, and every story is completely re-reported. Every source is recontacted. You know, everything. You know, just like down to the most minute turns of phrase. It actually adds a lot of time to the production process.
I'm sure that it does.
Yeah.
It's interesting to think about. I remember, of course, very clearly when that went down, and to think about the environment that we're living in now, where it feels dangerous in some ways to consume any kind of news or articles from places that you don't absolutely know are legit. There's just so much false information, so much propaganda being circulated. I mean, again, that's another real cultural shift that we seem to have gone through in just the last few years. How do you feel about this information age where so many of us are being bombarded with information that isn't real?
I mean, to me, it's the most alarming thing about the moment we're in. I mean, it isn't just that there's non-factual material and that it's being passed around so gleefully. It's that every single incident which happens from, you know, the caravan of people moving up to the southern border of the United States, to the Mueller report release, to anything really. It feels like there's a mainstream media fact-based take on it, and then there's a right-wing media take on it. You know, like whatever your feelings are about immigration, I feel like it's fine for people to disagree about that. And I talk to so many people who don't want more immigrants in this country. Like, that's totally fine. That's normal and normal in our political discourse. But, you know, for a political party and, you know, and all of right-wing media to be pushing the story that there's, like, you know, Islamic terrorists in this group and they're bringing up disease and all this stuff, which just wasn't true, or there was no proof that it was true. It doesn't seem like it was true. You know, like, you know, there's just no evidence they were presenting of it. But it being kind of like a talking point and broadly disseminated and broadly, well, who knows how well believed, but certainly disseminated, that to me, that's frightening. Like that's the environment that we're in now, and will be for the rest of our lives.
So ending on a happier note, for the last 20 some odd years, I think every intern or potential intern that I've interviewed, maybe 90% of those interns have told me that the first show that they fell in love with on public radio was This American Life. And you have started so many careers, piqued so much interest and gotten people excited about storytelling. And a lot of people start their efforts at storytelling by imitating you, by trying to be like Ira Glass. What do you say to people? What do you do to help people find their own voices and learn how to tell stories in their own way?
It's funny, like there isn't much speechifying. Like really, it's the kind of thing, like so many things, that you only learn by doing. And with new producers on the staff, we don't have an intern, but we have a production fellow, we call them. And, you know, we just try to get them out and reporting as soon as we can. And honestly, you only find your own voice in this by just starting to make stuff. You know, you just have to make stuff and make stuff and make stuff, and then you'll figure it out. And along the way, what we can do is we can, like, kind of help you before you go out and do your interviews, think about the structure of what you're going to make and think about what's interesting to you and think about what's funny and, you know, like what's amusing to you. I think it's like one of the things that people don't often tell young journalists is that, like, it's just as important to be like that you're choosing things that you're actually amused by and curious about and excited to investigate, you know, like that's as much what makes it good as all the proper, like, tools of journalism, like being sure everything's accurate and, you know, and presenting it in a clear way and structuring it properly. Like, you have to be excited, and if you're not going to be excited about it, like, you shouldn't do it.
Well, Ira, we are out of time, but thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks so much for having me.